Welcome to Criminalia, a production of Shondaland Audio in partnership with iHeartRadio.
Hello and welcome to the fourth season of Criminalia. It's pirate season. This time we're exploring the lives and motivations of some of the most notorious freebooters throughout history. I'm Maria Tremarkey.
And I'm Holly Fry. So she has been called the Pirate Queen, the Fierce Queen, and Teota the Untamable. She was born probably around 260 BCE and died around or shortly after 228 BCE.
Queen Teota is often considered the pirate queen of antiquity, but that's actually a little bit misleading. And it's misleading because she was not actually a pirate herself. While she might not be known for personally pillaging and looting, she is known for commanding an army of pirates throughout the Adriatic and Mediterranean seas. And she's also known for defying the Roman Republic.
Teota was the second wife of Agron, king of the Illyrians, and stepmother to Agron's infant son. We are not sure of the pronunciation on this one. We are guessing Pines. Under his leadership, the Ardian kingdom went through a period of expansion, and Agron was the first king to unify the tribes and regions between the Adriatic coast, from land that's now modern-day Slovenia, all the way to part of the Balkan Peninsula in Albania.
The Illyrians were tribes and states of people with similar language and customs, and they all lived in the same region. They were a loosely, and I'm going to repeat that, loosely tied nation. It's believed that the name was originally the name of a single tribe, and that upon meeting, the ancient Greeks and Romans misunderstood that and called all the tribes and states in the area Illyrians. Because of the available information, we're actually going to just use the word Illyrian in that more blanket sense, but keep in mind throughout that we are not talking about a monolith and that this is a construct of historians outside this culture.
Now, you may recognize the Illyrians because the name appears in Greek mythology, in battle in the legend of Cadmus and Harmonia. But to be clear, the Illyrians were also real people, and we're going to be talking about the real people and pirates and violence that took place during the 3rd century, during Queen Teota's reign.
King Agron ruled during the second half of the 3rd century BCE. He was the king who brought the Illyrian ships under the leader's umbrella control. So previously, these sailors had been independent, let's call them entrepreneurs, taking all they could get for themselves, until the king made their piracy part of his state policy.
Agron grew to have the most powerful army and navy of Illyrian rulers before him, and among his neighboring lands as well. Although he won and lost many battles, he is best known for his victory over the Aetolian League in western Greece. But it was this battle against the Aetolians that would also be his end. Around 231 BCE, Agron died suddenly. Some accounts suggest that the king was known to celebrate with the crews of his victorious ships, and that this time he overindulged. Other versions suggest that he died from complications of pleurisy, and yet others kind of make a combination package of this and suggest that he died of complications of pleurisy because he partied too hard with the pirates.
When he died, Pines, though the king's only heir, did not rule. He was actually really very young when his father died, and Teota stepped in to act as queen regent over the kingdom in his place.
So what we know about her rule are primarily accounts of her pro-piracy laws. Written accounts of her, though, have been considered sexist by some, and in general, are all written with a very pro-Greek or pro-Roman point of view. They were, after all, written by ancient Greeks and Romans. As we go along, remember, it is often best to take things with a grain of salt. Anytime you're talking about events as far back as the 3rd century BCE, the distance of time has made things a little blurry.
What's interesting and important about that is that the guy who primarily wrote about the Roman Republic's rise to power also wrote about this queen, and that's the account from which we draw most of our knowledge about Teota.
Enter Polybius. Polybius was a Greek statesman and historian. His works include a now-lost manual on military tactics, but he is best known for his writings called the Histories. Polybius was known to conduct interviews. He was essentially an early journalist, and he was considered to be an analytical historian. The details about many events from history are based on his interpretation and his writing about it. Today's scholars accept his work more or less at face value, largely because he himself touted an approach that recorded history should always have eyewitness accounts to verify any story. Modern historians Andrew Curry and Craig Champion consider Polybius to be, we quote, fairly reliable and remarkably well-informed, industrious, and insightful.
We will actually hear a lot of his thoughts as we continue, but right now we're going to take a break for a word from our sponsor. And when we're back, we'll talk about a queen who authorized piracy in her kingdom.
Welcome back to Criminalia. Let's start by talking about what the historian Polybius thought of Teota.
Polybius wrote about Teota, but he also wrote about her husband, Agron. I'm going to quote him here. Agron, he wrote, possessed the most powerful force, both by land and sea, of any of the kings who had reigned in Illyria before him.
He described Teota, though, as having a, quote, woman's natural shortness of view. He wrote that she, quote, could see nothing but the recent success and had no eyes of what was going on elsewhere. But what he does go on to mention about her is that the queen supported and encouraged piracy among her people and ordered her vessels to treat everyone as an enemy.
The Illyrians had a long and storied pirating tradition. They had long been preying on Italian merchants who traded in the Adriatic Sea. Just as under the deceased King Agron, piracy was legal under the queen. She outwardly supported and encouraged piracy, and throughout her whole reign, she kept it legal. In fact, it was considered a suitable, if not respectable, way of making a living in her kingdom. Piracy brought her more wealth and allowed her to shore up her own resources.
As queen and commander of the Illyrian pirates, Teota was bold. Remember, she wasn't doing it herself, but she was giving all of the orders. She sanctioned piracy in the Adriatic and the Mediterranean seas. She authorized those engaging in piracy. They were actually given licenses. These were letters of marque and reprisal issued by the government, making it legal for private citizens to basically become legal pirates. That was a career path. They are known, of course, as privateers or corsairs, and they're basically pirates who got paid to do it.
Teota used her privateers as her own private army, which sailed in well-armed ships. They were allowed to attack and capture merchant vessels at sea and pillage what they could find on land. And it was all legal, whether the victim was of a nation at war with the Illyrians or not. And it's then that the Illyrians became well-known, and maybe infamous or feared are better words here, for looting merchant ships.
I'm just thinking about the concept of, yes, this is your job. And also, you can do whatever illegal thing you want, but that's fine. It's still your job, and we'll sanction it.
And I'm going to give you this thing that looks like a driver's license, and it
right?
makes it all legal.
In the histories, Polybius wrote of the queen, quote, her first measure was to grant license to privateers, authorizing them to plunder all whom they fell in with. And she next collected a fleet and military force as large as the former one and dispatched them with general instructions to the leaders to regard every land as belonging to an enemy.
He continued on about Teota saying, from time immemorial, the Illyrians had oppressed and pillaged vessels sailing from Italy. They committed acts of piracy on a number of Italian merchants. Some they merely plundered, others they murdered, and a great many they carried off alive into captivity.
The Illyrians who sailed three main types of warships. These were Lembo, the Priestes, and the Liberna. All of these were pretty good for pirating. The Priestes was long and narrow as a warship. The Liburnian warship was powerful and it was propelled by oars. But their fastest and most agile and a very common choice for those engaging in piracy was the Lembo. This had a single bank of oars and no sails, and it was considered the best of the best of transport ships in the ancient world.
It's said the Illyrians packed as many as 100 pirates into the vessel's tight galley, and that was 50 men to row and 50 to fight. But probably give or take on those number of rowers, that seems really high. So the Illyrian piracy worked like this, and it seems very piratey, actually. crews in Lemnos hid in sheltered places along the coast, and they waited for merchant ships to come by. And when one did, they would row until they were alongside, they'd board, and then they'd overwhelm the crew and take whatever it was that they wanted.
Very efficient. That's why they need 50 dudes, because they got to be fast right. and quick about it. Merchants who were being plundered by these pirate ships asked for help from the states on the shores of the Adriatic. But no one really had the forces needed to fight these pirates. And at this time, the Romans really didn't see the need to get involved because the Illyrians had attacked a few merchants and threatened a lot of others.
Encouraged by their pirate commanding queen, and with no or very few repercussions from anyone else, crews increased their intensity of the attacks. Illyrian pirates overtook the city of Phinicae, and more than once, actually. Although sometimes the Illyrians were forced to withdraw their own troops because of an internal rebellion, it didn't happen all the time, but infighting among tribes was way more common than you might guess.
When not fighting among themselves, the Illyrian pirates did attack others. They violently defeated Epeiroche forces sent to fortify Phinicae. Many were killed or captured, and it's said that a garrison of 800 men surrendered to Teota's pirate crews. This was an attention-grabbing event. So, for example, had this happened in a time when media was widespread, it would have been front-page news kind of all over the globe.
Their piracy in the Adriatic, which included raiding Roman and Greek ships and coastal settlements, finally did catch the attention of Rome. It was when Teota's pirate ships began attacking Roman vessels that things started to escalate.
So we're going to take a quick break for a word from a sponsor, and when we're back, let's talk about why the Roman Republic would care at all about Queen Teota.
Welcome back to Criminalia. Now let's talk about the time when Queen Teota assassinated one, or maybe two, Roman envoys.
Okay, so we have to lay the groundwork for what's going on at this time. The Roman Republic had just defeated the Carthaginians. Because Rome had eyes on controlling the Mediterranean, they wanted this thriving port and this trading area. The Republic declared war in what became known as the First Punic War. Polybius described the Punic Wars, there were three between the empires, as, quote, the longest and most severely contested war in history. The Punic Wars were basically two empires battling for control of trade in the Mediterranean Sea. And this could easily be a whole episode in its own right if we were covering international conflicts instead of pirates.
That victory for the Romans was important because it boosted the Roman Republic's influence across the Mediterranean. But there was another rival on the rise that could get in their way. And that's Teota. So Teota and her assembly of pirates had begun to threaten and pillage vessels along trade routes that ran across the Adriatic Sea, and Roman vessels were pillaged as well.
Rome sent two envoys, Gaius and Lucius Coruncanius, to meet with the queen. And this was to try to dissuade her from continuing to pursue and encourage piracy. She insisted that she was simply not responsible for the actions of Illyrian privateers. Teota is said to have replied, quote, it was never the custom of royalty to prevent the advantage of its subjects that they could get from the sea. It is said that when one of the envoys sharply disagreed with her on this point, she ordered one of them, and possibly both of them, killed.
But here there are other accounts that suggest the queen's meeting with the Roman envoys went a little bit differently. In one really standout account by a Roman historian, it's written that Teota had not yet risen to power when the Roman Senate sent in their two ambassadors, and that changes the story quite a bit if it's true.
Regardless of whether Teota had already become the scourge of the Mediterranean or not, the Roman Republic was in a really strong position when Teota hit their radar. They had unified Italy, and they had recently defeated a significant rival for control over strategic positions in the Mediterranean Sea. And they were now the largest presence in the Mediterranean. But Teota refused to submit to them.
Teota's power was increasing, and after brutal attacks from her pirates on Roman trading vessels, the treatment of their envoys, and the fact that they really, really wanted trade in the Adriatic, the Roman Senate deployed their navy against her.
And when the Romans attacked, they were fierce and methodical. And they tried to parlay that loose association of groups that made up the Illyrians into suggesting that pirates sailing for Teota had been pressed into it. They traveled up the Adriatic coast, quote, freeing, again, that is with quotes, freeing these Illyrian crews along the way. And each of these boats was told that they were now under Roman protection. Again, that's air quotes. Although Rome didn't station any troops in these allegedly newly freed areas. So there really was no protection there whatsoever. They also tried to convince the Illyrian pirates that the Roman Republic was their new, and one more time with those air quotes, friend. Hey, we're friends. We're pals.
Friends.
Listen, guys, friends don't attack friends. Everybody be cool.
It was around this time that Demetrius Sepharos, he was the advisor / military general to Teoda. He turned traitor. Seeing that the odds were not good against Rome, or just maybe out of fear, he turned his loyalties away from the queen and collaborated with the Republic instead, and he even acted as Rome's counsel in the war against Teoda. And that betrayal was decisive in the conflict.
Over the course of just a few weeks, Rome destroyed Teoda's kingdom, and the unification of Illyrian tribes that King Agron had accomplished was gone. This was the beginning of what would come to be known as the Illyrian Wars, a series of conflicts between Rome and the Illyrians for control of trade across the Adriatic Sea. The first battle, which is this battle we're talking about, lasted for 2 years. And when the Romans completely overwhelmed the Illyrian garrison at Corcyra, Queen Teoda surrendered. Rome placed a few terms on her surrender, including, of course, abdication of the throne. Many accounts report that Teoda was actually given a small region that she could rule, but we can't prove that. That's not verified in any sort of real way.
There are, of course, a few versions of what happened when Teoda surrendered. There's one that says she begged the Romans for a truce. There's another that says she was fined and forced to surrender most of her kingdom to the Republic. And there was one thing that seemed to be part of a few of these stories, actually, that she was forbidden from ever again setting sail with more than 2 ships, that would be 2 lembos in particular, beyond southern Illyria. This one comes up a lot because I think it makes sense. This would keep her personally from engaging in piracy and with pirates and with her pirate crews. The final one here is actually much different about her surrender. And this story in her legend tells that she allegedly threw herself off of a cliff rather than surrender to the Roman Republic.
Perhaps not surprisingly, and almost certainly because it's the most dramatic, the most popular story of her surrender is that one where she throws herself off of a cliff. And that piece of her legend remains today as a curse on Rizin. That's an ancient town in the Bay of Kotor, Montenegro. That curse? Rizin is a town that Teoda had fled to and is now the only town in the region without a real seafaring tradition. And the lore tells us that before plunging to her death, she cursed this town to never be able to build a seafaring vessel there, basically saying, if I die here, so does this region's relationship with the sea.
Despite the fact that that is the most dramatic and most popular story of her death, we don't actually know if that's how she died. We don't know at all how her life ended. And if she didn't die at this point, it's unclear what happened to this pirate queen after 228 BCE. There's no evidence that would corroborate the jumping off a cliff to her death story. Neither has a tomb ever been uncovered, so we don't know the reason for anyone's cause of death in this story because of the same reason. It's the 3rd century BCE, so it's not entirely strange. And as we said, given how far back these events took place, it's sometimes really hard to know.
So when it comes to Teoda, we don't know if she was better or worse or completely different than what historians captured and wrote down. And the same is really true of everyone that we just talked about. History, modern and ancient, is full of rulers who were powerful women. Women who might stand up to the Roman Republic, women who are still celebrated today, whether they led an army of pirates or they did the pirating themselves. So Teoda has her own sort of folk hero status, even if her story can't be verified. Maria, would you like to step inside the groggery?
I will be right there.
Okay, so I wanted to think about a spirit that is associated with the Mediterranean. Now, if you look up Albanian spirits, a lot of them are very fruit-based.
Mm-hmm.
Those are cool, and it's very, if you'll forgive the accidental kind of wordsmanship, they're very ripe for potential experimentation. But this is another one where I wanted to make something that might not be what people think they will like, but is surprisingly yummy. So instead, I went with another Mediterranean spirit. It starts with ouzo.
Oh my God. All right. So what are we calling
it? Okay. So I love ouzo, and I know it's not for everyone because it's, you know, anise and it has that licorice-y flavor. I love an anisette. I love an ouzo. Any of the European licorice liquors I'm into. But I thought it would be fun since that, you know, is most associated with Greece, which was an area where she was sailing and potentially like some of her privateers may have brought her some back. So it ties into the whole story.
Yeah.
And I also wanted to do something that nods to the use of citrus in the area, which is pretty common both in the cuisine and the beverages. So it's essentially a lemonade and ouzo-based drink. I'm calling it Teota's Curse, but it isn't a curse. It's, in fact, delicious.
You made me a drink.
Right. So I discovered in prepping for this that if you squirrel around online, there are a lot of people that do kind of a lemonade with ouzo. And there are variations. Mine is the easy peasy version because most of them want you to do like a more from the ground up, from scratch kind of lemonade base where you use juice and water and you add honey or some other sweetener. I think you can just grab lemonade from the store. It's fine.
Yeah.
And I did that and I got like a lower sugar lemonade because I usually do. It is 1 ounce of ouzo, 1 ounce of vodka. I used a citrus vodka, like a grapefruit vodka, and that was yummy. But you can also just use your basic straight clean vodka. And then I did about 5 ounces of lemonade and I shook it all together and just poured it over ice. You can, you know, garnish that with a piece of citrus or with a little mint sprig if you want to just add a nice aromatic to it. Here's what's interesting.
I'll have everyone know that she leaned in as she said that.
Here's the thing. I know that not everybody likes licorice flavored things. Anise doesn't work for everyone, including my guinea pig, i.e. my beloved husband. But I asked him, I was like, just try this, though, because something happens when you mix the ouzo and the lemonade where that licorice-y flavor gets countered by the citrus in a way that makes it not quite what I think most people are responding to when they say they don't like anise flavor. And he was like, this is not bad at all. And so that to me is like a resounding,
that's
huge endorsement of this drink. Because that's about as enthusiastic as he's going to get regarding a cocktail with ingredients he's suspicious of. I absolutely loved it. I thought it was so delicious and super yummy. And I see why a lot of people have done this sort of combo or some variation on it. If you want to do a non-alcoholic version, it's very easy, but it does require you to be a little bit careful. I used a dropper and I put about 3 drops of anise extract, like that you would get for baking, in the base of my glass over some ice. And then I poured the lemonade on top of it and gave it a good stir. The reason I say you want to be very careful is that anytime you're dealing with an extract, it's so highly concentrated that like you can easily go overboard.
Absolutely.
Like you don't want to get a single spoon involved. You literally want drops. Not even your quarter teaspoon. You want only drops. The good news is if you overdo it, you can just keep adding lemonade until you get the mix you like. You can even dilute with water a little bit. Also, since we're kind of in that time, even though this has been a blisteringly hot summer, and it doesn't really feel like we're in autumn yet. But it's like a nice transition flavor from summer into autumn because that licorice little undercurrent gives it a nice, hey, we're heading into.
Yeah, yeah. It's like
more
a warm
robust
flavor.
Flavors. Yeah. That is Teota's Curse. I am going to drink a lot of these in the future. Well, because they're interesting. It's an unusual flavor that you're not normally getting.
I think it's interesting on the palate, actually. I'm curious to try.
Right.
Yeah.
It's very refreshing and it's easy as pie to throw together. So like it's a great one to do in a pitcher form if you're having people over who are willing to take that walk with you, even if you are not a licorice person. The other thing I was going to say is that if people, for whatever reason, don't have access to ouzo, you can also do this with any kind of licorice liqueur, like any kind of anisette will work fine. It'll change the profile a little bit because they just concentrate a little bit differently, but it will still be very yummy. I tried it, a quick version with an anisette, and it was also delicious.
I'm super excited about this drink. It has things in it that I, like everything in it, I love.
Listen, I try to take care of you when I can.
You really do. I feel like this drink is made for me.
So if you try it, we hope that you love it. We also hope you've enjoyed this little chat we've had today and spending time with us. We're so grateful that you do so. We have so many more pirates on the horizon. So thank you for spending time with us this week. And there is going to be more next week, also with drinks. Criminalia is a production of Shondaland Audio in partnership with iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from Shondaland Audio, please visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.